Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it is January 26th, Tuesday, first lecture of the week. We're going to continue with chemistry. All right, and you guys up there are going to have to shut up, okay? I don't mind. I like having a lively class, but not if it interrupts what the other people are trying to hear me. And I run out of voice sometimes if I have to yell, so that'd be really good. I had a couple emails saying that people went to the publisher's website but couldn't, and they didn't have a password to log into mhhe.com. And I just want to remind everybody that you do not need a password to get into that. You just have to click resources, which is on the top header on the left-hand side of the page, and I'll show you that in just a second after I boot up a browser. All right, so you don't need password or anything to work the practice quizzes. And those of you that are starting those practice quizzes right now, that's great, right? Because those questions are not really easy questions. They're pretty critical, I think. And that's the level that the test is going to be at, right? So you practice those questions. I lift some of those questions right off the web, put it on the test, and you can nail the first test. But the history of this class is that people don't take me seriously until maybe the third test. So if you want to get an A in the class and make it easy on yourself at the end, get an A on the first test by studying those online questions, studying the exam figures that are in the exam study guide. Okay? So don't procrastinate with that one. I'll show you where that is in just a second. Yeah?
Do we have to
submit it? Oh, no. Please don't submit. It's not for grade. This is not a hybrid class or an online class. This is just an on-campus class, so I can't have any grading online. But in the fall, it will be a hybrid class. So I don't know if you like computer-aided classes or not. And if you don't, and for some reason you want to take the class with me, then this is the semester you have to do it, because the class is going to change to a hybrid class in the fall. Okay? And I think that's an advantage, but it's a little bit more work on the students, right? Any kind of online class usually requires a little bit more initiative on a student's part to get through it. So that's a good thing. All right, so I had another question about the lectures, where you can find them. So I opened up the syllabus right here, and here is the link. It's a Microsoft Word document, but you can put hyperlinks in Word documents, right, as of, I don't know, to me it seems recently, but maybe it's been 10 years already, I'm not sure. But how do you activate that link? You press Control, and notice the cursor changes to a pointy hand, and that takes you to, all right, that should open up a browser. Okay, here it is. All right, so that's the website. What class do you want? You want 241, Human Physiology. I didn't see what's funny here? Okay. Oh, yeah. See what you guys do to me? Okay, so here, you want to click Spring, Tuesday and Thursday, 2:10 lectures? Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Oh, you can get a Cypress College and put the little stamp that you get on there, too. Yeah, I'll show you mine. All right, so here are the lectures. Lecture 1, January 19th, 2010. Okay, somebody said I had 2009 in there. Who was that? Lecture, January 21st, 2010. Now, these right here, they're not linked. All right, so what I did is I just copied the HTML page from fall 2009, made a duplicate page, and as the semester goes, I'll change the dates right here as I put the links as appropriate. Okay, so I just used the previous semester as a template. All right, so if you see 2009, it's not even an active link yet, because we haven't this is the lecture for today, right? When I upload that over the weekend, then here will be the one for Thursday. Okay, all right, so and then don't forget, these text files are from a previous semester as well. They won't be an exact duplicate of what I say, because it takes about $7,000 to transcribe a whole class into a text file, right? So it's pretty pricey. Okay, and what was I going to show you? I was going to show you, who knows the link? You know, I'm not sure I have that link in the syllabus. I should probably put it in the syllabus. Is it www? Dot mhhe.com. I think that's it. Redirects you to, oh, That doesn't look like it. Somebody tell me what it is. Look in your book. Okay, so there's no www in front of it? Oh, there is. Oh, I didn't put the Fox in there. Okay. Let's just do it real quick. Right. Because I also ask you to look at the preview edition, too, which would be Fox 10. All right, so this is, we can go to Fox, what, 11? Is that it? Yeah? Okay. Let's go there. All right, so now to get into this website, you don't have to use a password and a username. Just hit resources. All right, everybody see, I just clicked resources, and here are the resources for Chapter 1. Animation quizzes, they might be pretty good study tools. Animation quizzes, practice tests, that's what we want. Here, simple, difficult. Okay, so that gets you started. Okay, you can look at some of these other positive and negative feedback. That's probably good to look at. They're really short. Answer a couple questions. Don't submit them. Just for your own practicing. Labeling exercises for Chapter 1 basically come out of their anatomy book. So if you need to review your histology, go for it. But I think you all should know your histology already, right? So just hit resources and you're good. Same thing for Fox 10. Just hit resources right there. Okay. Anybody else got any other questions? Oh, yeah, I should put MHE right there. But it's plastered almost on every page in your book. All right, so we're talking chemistry. And let me start the slideshow. Get my arrow options going. All right, so we were talking about atoms. And what makes one kind of element different from another kind of element? Conceptually, what is it and what do we call it? What's the term for that? You guys need to start working with this material a little bit so you don't get behind the eight ball. It's the number of protons inside the nucleus. If we change the number of protons inside the nucleus, the element changes. It changes from carbon to oxygen or whatever. How are you going to know what element contains a certain number of protons? What are you going to have available to you? Periodic table. So you have to know the chemical symbols and how it corresponds to the English word for that particular element. All right, it's covered up right here. And it'll be covered up for the test, but I'll give you a periodic table that doesn't have the English words on it. All right, so magnesium, how many protons does magnesium have? 12, right? What do you call that number? That is the atomic number, right? The atomic number. There's also something called atomic mass that we don't talk about, but if you add the number of neutrons to the number of protons, that would be the mass, atomic mass. That's not so important for this class. All right, and then to be electrically neutral, you should have the exact equal number of electrons in orbitals around the nucleus, and that's a fairly stable condition when there's no overall electrical charge on an atom, but sometimes that's not the most stable. Can anybody tell me the condition that an atom is the most stable? When is an atom most stable? Right, when the valence shell or the outer shell is completely filled up. And the first shell contains how many? Two. And then the second shell? Eight. So if you have an atom with nine protons inside the nucleus, right, it wants to accept an electron from someplace to fill that outermost shell. And when it does, it will become a negative material. And what do we call an atom that's negative? It's an anion, right? If it's minus one, it's a monovalent anion. Okay. And what can you tell me about opposite charges? Do they attract or repel? They attract. So if you have anions together with cations, they will attract each other. What do we call that attraction? When oppositely charged ions, they attract each other by opposite charge, they can form something. Ionic bond. So somebody had a question about an ionic bond. Can I go over an ionic bond? Well, I just kind of did in English, right? So your textbook has some nice graphics on how that develops. And if you want me to draw it out for you, maybe you should see me after class or something. Okay? So that's the kind of thought process that you go through to think about ions and ionic bonds. All right? Those charges are there. And now, what can you tell me about water? Is it an ion or not an ion? Is it an ion or not an ion? Overall, it does not have a charge. But if you look in a small little neighborhood of a water molecule, you see that it does have a charge, right? A water molecule is polar. Therefore, anything that has electrical charges on it can dissolve in water very easily. We call those polar compounds, right? So ions dissolve in water very nicely. As a matter of fact, any kind of element that is very electronegative, that has a tendency to pull orbiting electrons toward its nucleus, right, will become a polar compound. Because water, the oxygen in water does the same thing. It pulls electrons away from the protons. All right, so those protons that are sticking out to the side generate a little positive force on the ends of the water molecule. All right, there are some other elements that produce polar covalent bonds besides oxygen. What are some other elements that produce polar covalent bonds? That means that these nuclei, these elements, have a tendency to take the electron from hydrogen and pull it to itself, and it leaves that positive charge just kind of hanging out in space, just like a water molecule. Okay? I don't know if I would say hydrogen, but for sure, nitrogen, oxygen, sulfur, phosphorus. That's good. So those kinds of compounds, when they covalently bind a hydrogen atom, produce polar compounds. And so any of these compounds that have like an SH bond on it can dissolve in water very nicely. Okay, so we're going to be really concerned about these different domains, the polar domain versus a nonpolar domain. What kind of compounds are nonpolar? We're going to look at a bunch of these. Like lipids and fats. And you all know that lipids and fats just don't dissolve in water. And now you're beginning to understand why that is a little bit. Because they don't have, basically they don't have phosphorus, sulfur, oxygen, or nitrogen on them that have been bound to a hydrogen atom. They don't have any of these polar covalent bonds. All right, last thing that we talked about last time was the different kinds of bonds that can be formed. And we know four. And I want to go over this because the fourth one is maybe a little obscure and some people have forgotten it. What are the kinds of bonds that we looked at already? Covalent is one. Ionic is another. Hydrogen is one. And van der Waals forces. Now, they don't all have the same strength. Which one is the weakest? Van der Waals. Which one's the strongest? Covalent is the strongest. Okay, and how would you quickly describe a covalent bond? Sharing of those valence electrons. Okay, what's the next weakest after covalent? Ionic. And now, how could you quickly describe to me an ionic bond? Transfer of electrons. Right. And the last kind, hydrogen bond, is that strong? Yeah, that's got to be weaker than an ionic bond. And that's due to, what, either the oxygen, sulfur, nitrogen, or phosphorus pulling electrons to itself, kind of denuding that proton so that it becomes a little bit positive in that area of the molecule, and that oxygen or phosphorus becomes a little bit more negative because it is attracting those electrons. All right, so those are the things we covered last time. And we also learned about cations and anions. All right. So now let's talk about acids and bases. Probably talked about acids and bases all the time, but maybe you didn't realize what the heck they were. All right, so water, here, what's water? H2O, right? So water can actually dissociate. It can break apart. It can form two ions. Here are a couple ions. All right, so here is a hydrogen atom, and here is an OH molecule, and it just so ends up that the OH takes the electron from that hydrogen atom and becomes, what, an anion, monovalent anion, And when you have a hydrogen atom that has a proton in the nucleus and an electron in this orbital right here, right, and then you take that electron away, what are you left with? What are you left with right here? What is that thing? Different ways you can think about it. So I want to talk about both ways. It's a positive charge. Yeah, what do we call a subatomic particle that has a positive charge? Proton. Okay, that's a proton. And you could just as well call it a hydrogen ion. Hydrogen ion or a proton are exactly the same thing. A hydrogen atom with an electron ripped off of it is a proton, but it's also what? A hydrogen ion. It's an ion because you have that positive charge. People use those terms interchangeably all the time. All right? And that electron ended up over here. This is a hydroxide anion. Okay, so another way of saying this, if we put a hydroxide anion and a proton together, what can you make? You can make water out of it. Notice this is a bidirectional arrow right here. That can go backwards and forwards. All right, so that's sort of like a chemical reaction, but it's a state of equilibrium that's maintained all the time. And what determines the pH of something, of a solution, is the amount of hydrogen ions that are in that solution, or the number of protons. Right? So that will also determine the acidity of that particular solution. So we can measure the pH of a fluid, but what has to be in that fluid? Okay, you can have gasoline, but gasoline, do you think gasoline has water in it? Okay. It really doesn't, maybe a trace amount, but basically gasoline is a nonpolar solvent. It doesn't have water, so it really doesn't make sense to measure the pH of gasoline because it's never going to have protons in it. It's got to be an aqueous solution. It's got to be a solution of water in order to measure the pH or the acidity. Okay. All right, so the acidity... Right, acidity. As the acidity increases, all right, then what can you tell me about the hydrogen ion? And when I say concentration, I usually put brackets around there. That's just a chemistry nomenclature. So instead of writing proton concentration, I just use that little nomenclature. What happens to the number of protons in solution as it becomes more acidic? Okay, it increases. Right, so, and if the acidity goes down, what happens to the concentration of protons or hydrogen ions? It decreases. This is a nice relationship, really nice and simple. We say it's directly related. We're going to use this term a lot. When it's directly related, if one variable increases, the one on the other side of the equation increases. Okay, so acidity is equal to the concentration of hydrogen ions in solution. All right, so an acid is a compound that when we put it in water, it breaks down to increase the hydrogen ion concentration in the solution. A really good example that I have, it's a very strong acid. We have hydrochloric acid. All right, let me get my marker working again. Hydrochloric acid, when we put it in water, it's going to dissociate into hydrogen ions and chloride ions. It's going to completely dissociate. And so you're producing millions or billions of these molecules right here. What's going to happen to the acidity of that solution when you put hydrochloric acid in it? Right, if you increase the number of protons, that increases the acidity. Right. So here are some very common kinds of acids. Some of these are important biologically, like phosphoric acid is, we use that in our bodies. Carbonic acid, that's important in our bodies. Right? Hydrochloric is not important. Nitric and sulfuric acid, those really aren't important for us. Unless you spill them on yourself, then, of course, that will burn you or dissolve your body away, so that's not really good. Okay? All right. The opposite of that is something that's going to increase the hydroxide ion concentration. And so what we call a compound that doesn't increase hydrogen ions when we put it in solution, but hydroxide ions. That's a base. All right, so here is an example. What's a good example of a base that we have right here? Sodium hydroxide, NaOH. When we put this in water, right, what can you tell me about that sodium? Does that sodium want to go into water? We end up with sodium ions. Is that soluble in water? Absolutely, because water is a polar solvent. Anything that has electrical charges will be accepted into the water solution very, very easily. And then we're left over with, what is that little beast right there? That's a hydroxide ion or anion. All right, so anything that produces these hydroxide ions in solution, that's a base. So that's why sodium hydroxide is a base. Now, we're interested in these compounds because these molecules, hydrogen ions and hydroxide ions, are super reactive. They change the chemistry of the solution that they're in. All right, can drastically change the chemical properties of a solution. And basically, your life processes are just chemical reactions that are taking place. And since pH will affect those chemical reactions, your body has to regulate the number of hydrogen ions that are in solution in your body. Okay. All right, here's the next thing. We got to realize what pH is all about. All right, and some students get really messed up with pH. So you got these equations down right here. I'm going to erase the chemical reactions. And I'm going to draw a couple beakers. Right here, so here we got a beaker. And here we got a beaker. Let me see if I got another good marker right here. Here we got another beaker. And let's put some ions in here. All right, and let's do the same for this one. All right, so what am I drawing? I'm drawing hydrogen ions or hydroxide ions in these beakers, okay? And I want you to tell me which one is acidic and which one is basic. Okay, so if we look at a beaker and we see this beaker right here has many more hydrogen ions than it does hydroxide anions, it means that this is acidic, right? And if we put hydrochloric acid in there, it will produce even more protons, which will make it even more acidic, right? All right. So this is acidic. And what can you tell me about this solution right here? It's neutral. Oh, why do you see it's neutral? Because this positive charge negates that one or cancels that out. This positive cancels that one out, right? So you have a neutral solution if the concentration of hydrogen ions is equal to the concentration of hydroxide ions, right? So this is neutral. That's neutral. And this one, okay, you can probably deduce this is basic because it has more hydroxide ions than it does protons in solution. What's a proton again? Hydrogen ion, right, same thing. All right, now, if we look at this chart right here, so you should become familiar with carbonic acid and phosphoric acid. None of these bases really are too important for you. All right, let's look at this table right here. Okay, so here we have the concentration of hydrogen ions in this column. Here we have the molar concentration of hydroxide ions. And let's look at this row right here. And we see that it's 1 times 10 to the minus 7th molar. Okay, and what's this word right here? It says neutral. So when a solution is neutral, we said the concentration of hydrogen ions, right, which will be 10 to the minus 7, has got to be equal to the concentration of hydroxide ions in solution, which would be 10 to the minus 7th, right? 1 times 10 to the minus 7th. They're exactly equal. That makes a neutral solution. All right, so what pH does is this equation right here, let me flip back one, it's pH, right? pH is equal to the log of 1 over the hydrogen ion concentration. And when you put a 10 to the minus 7th right here, and right, take the inverse of it and press the little log button on your computer or your calculator, which you might have to do for the test, guess what number you get? You get a 7. All right, so that's the reason why we say when the water system, the water solution has equal numbers, right here the pH is 7 because it comes from this little number in the exponent. All right, and as this number gets bigger, right, and bigger and bigger, let's stick with hydrogen ions. As this number gets smaller and smaller and smaller, right, the exponent right here, what can you tell me about the value of this number? Which number is bigger, 0.001 or 1? 1 is a lot bigger, which means what? That the concentration is a lot higher here, right? Orders of magnitude, right? So as this exponent, because it's a minus number, gets bigger and bigger and bigger, that means hydrogen ions are going away, okay? And when you put it into that equation, look what happens to the pH scale. The pH scale number, the pH number gets bigger and bigger and bigger as what happens to the concentration of hydrogen ions? Decreases. All right, so that's a tricky thing for you guys to remember. As the pH number gets bigger, the solution becomes what? More basic. All right, so the pH number is what we say inversely related to the acidity of the solution. The pH number actually increases as the pH, I have to go back and try to listen to what I said. The pH number increases as the acidity decreases. They go in opposite ways. That's inversely related. So as pH goes up, what about the acidity? It goes down. All right? As the pH goes up, acidity goes down. As the pH number goes down, what happens to acidity? It goes up. But in your mind, you should be thinking what? As something becomes more acidic, the number of hydrogen ions increases. And as the hydrogen ions increase, the pH number goes down, okay, because of this equation right here. And you've got some problems at the back of the chapter to work to calculate pH. All right, so you know how to use your calculator. And your lab instructor would be very happy to work those equations with you. It's just punching a log button. Okay. So that is pH. All right, you might have to listen to that lecture again, but don't get turned around when you think of pH, because as the pH goes down, hydrogen ion concentrations go up, okay, becomes more acidic. Okay. Well, the pH inside our bodies, actually inside our blood, is about 7.35. Now, what can you tell me about that number? Is that acidic or is it neutral or basic? Okay. Well, you have a really nice slide. Let's see if I can find the slide right here. Do I have it? This is as good as we get. Okay. So what's neutral? 7. And as the number gets smaller than 7, it becomes acidic. And as it gets a little bit higher than 7, it becomes basic. So 7.35 is a little bit basic. All right, so we're a little bit basic inside our bodies. And don't forget, these hydrogen ions are very reactive. It changes the biochemistry or chemistry inside of our bodies a lot. So your body has to maintain this pH through homeostatic mechanisms, right? If it changes a lot, or even just a little bit, that could produce death. All right, some people, okay, under certain circumstances, this number might be able to go to 7.45 or 7.5 if their body can adjust over a period of weeks, for instance, right? But if you were to drink a big Slurpee from 7-Eleven, which is Coca-Cola, and the pH of Coca-Cola might be about 1, between 1 and 0, which means what? Acidic or basic or neutral? It's very acidic. A lot of hydrogen ions in that big Coca-Cola. So you drink that whole Coca-Cola, what's that going to add to your body? Acidity. What would happen to this number? Go up or go down? It should go down. It might drop, for instance, to 7.1. All right? And if it were, that would be fatal. Your body can't change pH that rapidly because that would be the end of you. So when we eat acidic foods or basic foods all the time, why is it that we can eat these substances without croaking? And that takes us to the next topic. Because our bodies have other kinds of chemicals in them that we call buffers. And buffers are molecules that resist changes in pH when either an acid or a base is added to solution. So we can add hydrochloric acid to a buffer, right? And what's going to happen to the pH? It's not going to change. Okay? We can add sodium hydroxide to a buffer system, and what's going to happen to the pH? It's not going to change. All right? So here's something pretty important. A buffer doesn't force solutions to go to pH 7, which is neutral. You could have a solution that's maybe 7.35, like our bodies, add an acid or a base to it, and our bodies will remain at 7.35 because we have buffers. All right? So buffers will just allow a solution to exist at a certain pH without changing. Right, a buffer doesn't force something to go to neutrality. Some students get mixed up with that. So buffers don't maintain a pH of 7. They maintain the pH of, depending on the chemical that's the buffer. All right, so we have a number of different buffers in our body. We'll talk about them. Okay, here is an important buffer system. All right, and this is the bicarbonate buffer system that we have in blood. So we've got H2O. What's that?
Water.
Got a lot of water in blood. Our cells produce CO2. This is a byproduct of making ATP in our body. Okay, and if we put CO2 in water, it forms carbonic acid. We talked about carbonic acid is one of the important acids that you should know biologically in your body. And this molecule right here can actually dissociate. It can break apart, and it breaks apart into hydrogen ion and bicarbonate anion. All right, so what is produced when CO2 builds up in your body? It produces hydrogen ions, which means it makes your body more acidic. Okay. All right. Right. So CO2 actually is acting like an acid right here. But this is a buffer because you have all of these compounds in your body because your body is making CO2 all the time. And what can you tell me about these arrows right here? Are they pointing one way? Bidirectional. I just couldn't figure out the right keystrokes to put one on top of the other. But the chemical reaction can go back one way or the other. And the reaction is not favored in one direction or the other, except by the concentrations of these compounds right here. Let me erase the beakers. So I want to tell you a little bit about the law of mass action right now, and when we get to it in the slides, I won't have to say quite so much about it. If we have a number of chemicals in solution, like chemical A and B, these things maybe could join together to form two other kinds of chemicals. Let's just say C plus D, and let's just say that this is a bidirectional equation. It can go backwards and forwards. What's going to determine if the equation is going to go forwards, meaning from left to right, or backwards from right to left? All right, it's going to be the concentrations of these compounds right here will determine which way the chemical reaction goes. So if we put a lot of C, if we add a lot of C into the beaker or the cell or whatever, it's going to force the reaction back in this direction. Okay. If we remove C from this system right here, then A and B are going to combine to build up the concentration of C back to almost where it was. So it's going to force the reaction in this direction. All right, so let me just ask you a question. Let's put C back over there. And which way is the reaction going to be forced if we add a lot of A? What's going to happen? If we put a lot of A, is it going to go forwards or backwards? It's going to go forwards. All right, that's the law of mass action, or sometimes it's called Le Chatelier's principle. I have it written down for you in your slides. Okay, so when some chemical reactions, like the one that I have on the slide, when one component builds up, it forces the reactants, oh, I should probably put that in there, reactants, all right, to the right. So if these are reactants on the left, what do we call these little jobbers here on the right? These are products. Okay, law of mass action or Le Chatelier's principle. That's almost right. If somebody speaks French, you could work with my accent on that one. Le Chatelier. Ah, that's better. Le Chatelier. Okay. All right. So let's look at this bicarbonate buffer system. When you're exercising, producing a lot of CO2, all right, what builds up inside your body? It becomes acidic. Hydrogen ions build up, okay? Or if other kinds of compounds, right, if you don't produce a lot of CO2, if you eat or drink that Coke that is highly acidic, your body is being what? The hydrogen ion concentration is rising. What is this system allowed to take place? All right? If we increase the hydrogen ion concentration, does this reaction get forced in the forward direction or the backward direction? Backward direction. So if we eat an acidic food, hydrogen ion concentration increases. That doesn't kill us because it combines with bicarbonate ion that we have in our body, and it what? Neutralizes it. So that maintains our pH. And you don't have just this bicarbonate buffer system, but we have numerous buffer systems in our body. There's phosphate buffers. We looked at the phosphoric acid, but all proteins act as buffers. So we can change our diet drastically in terms of pH, in terms of eating acids or bases without it harming us very much. Okay. All right. So this reaction, don't forget, can go back in either direction. All right. So the normal range for blood is 7.35, 7.45. If it goes beyond those levels, that produces a disease state, right? It's beyond, the homeostasis is not being maintained for whatever reason. If it goes below 7.35, what does that mean? Becoming more basic or more acidic? If it goes below 7.35, maybe what? 7.0. 7.0 is less than 7.35. That's what? More acidic. And once it meets this threshold right here, we call that an acidosis. And if it goes above 7.45, that's an alkalosis. That's a disease state. And, of course, you want to find out why that's happening to somebody. Okay. All right, so that's pH. Who's got a question on pH? You might not even be familiar enough with pH to ask a question at the moment, right? Because things are going up and down. You got to study. You got to think about that a little bit. Okay. Okay, but I would be happy to talk about pH a little bit more.
Can you pass on the
Yeah, really good. Thanks for reminding me. I got it right here. All right, so the crux issue is, as the hydrogen ion increases, does the solution become more acidic or basic? More acidic. But what happens to the pH number? It goes down, right? So if you can follow that, listen to the tape, then you're doing good. All right, you just got to remember which way things are going. Okay, organic molecules. Let's talk about some organic molecules. Compounds can be broken down into organic molecules and inorganic molecule, right? Organic or inorganic. And an organic molecule contains a carbon atom. This is a partial description because I want to review a little bit. How many protons does carbon have inside the nucleus? How would you know? You look at the periodic table. This could be on the test. How many protons are in there? Yeah, 6. You could say it a little bit more forcefully. It's got 6 protons inside the nucleus. All right. But that doesn't make an organic compound. It also has to have something else. All right. It's got to have a hydrogen that is covalently bound to that carbon. It's got a molecule has got to have both a carbon atom and a hydrogen bound to it by a covalent bond. All right, should we draw what carbon looks like really quick? Somebody had a question about bonds. You've got what? 6 protons inside the nucleus right here, 6 pluses. The first shell has got how many electrons? All right, so here's 1, here's 2. How many are left? four. There are four electrons left. Here's one, here's two, here's three, here's four. How does carbon feel all by itself? Really strange, right? Because it's looking for what? Four electrons to fill this outer shell. And it can find a hydrogen atom, which has one proton in the nucleus and one electron in an orbital right here that helps fill the shell up. But this carbon atom is actually going to look for what? Four protons. That would give us a molecule CH4, all right, which we call methane. That's not important biologically unless you have a lot of indigestion or something, okay? But this is an organic compound because why? It's got a carbon atom and it has covalently bound hydrogens to it. It's got to have both. Now, it doesn't mean that other molecules aren't important biologically, like what's this one here? Is that important biologically? That's probably the most important, but is it organic? No, water is inorganic. All right. What about our body? We just looked at the bicarbonate buffer system based on CO2. What can you tell me about CO2? Important biologically, because we produce it, we excrete it from our bodies all the time. Is it organic or inorganic? It's inorganic. It's got carbon, but what else does it have to be organic? It's got to have hydrogens. Does it have any hydrogens in there? Nope. It's inorganic, right? So there's some familiarity of these compounds that you have to be aware of a little bit. Okay. All right, so here are some organic molecules. Would you agree that hexane right here is organic? Yeah, it's got what? It's got carbon and what else? Hydrogen by a covalent bond, right? So this little line right here represents a nice covalent bond, which actually means what? What is that little line? Sharing of electrons, right? Sharing of electrons. So, but now hexane, is that an important biological molecule? Not in the least, unless you come in contact with it. It's probably carcinogenic, okay? But we don't, our bodies don't produce it, don't use it for anything, okay? This molecule right here has how many carbons? Six, and therefore the name hexane, okay? So it's got six carbons, and this actually can form a cyclic ring. This end can bend back and bind to this ring right here and form this structure. So this is just a shorthand notation for this molecule when it forms a cyclic ring. Instead of drawing all of these carbons and hydrogens, we just symbolize it by this thing that kind of looks like a stop sign, all right? That would be cyclohexane, all right? And then there's special things that can happen, right? It can form double bonds between the carbons, right? And that would be benzene. Benzene, so these are all, what, organic molecules, but not important biologically, and they're all kind of nasty molecules, right? So I just want you to be aware of this. And so most of the chemicals that your body deals with has, nonetheless, this carbon backbone associated with it, with either hydrogens or other kinds of atoms bound in these positions. And depending on what's bound in these positions right here, that's going to change the nature of the molecule and what the job of that molecule is in the body, right? So when we change the elements on these different positions right here, we're changing the structure of the molecule. And when we change the structure of something, what else happens? The function is going to change as well, right? So that's something that I want you to be aware of. When you change the structure of something, then the function is going to change. All right, so here are some different substitutions of chemical compounds on this carbon right here. And we're going to call these functional groups. And I do want you to know the names of these functional groups and what they look like. Okay? So when you have a carbon with a double bond, that's what we call a carbonyl. And here we have a carbon with an OH group. That's what we call hydroxyl. You think there's going to be a difference in function between this hydroxyl group and this carbonyl group? Yeah, because the structure is changing. Okay? All right, furthermore, let's look at this hydroxyl group right here. We have an oxygen with this hydrogen. What can you tell me about this covalent bond between this oxygen and hydrogen? Is it polar or nonpolar? Is it polar or non-polar? What were the four atoms that produce polar covalent bonds when it binds a hydrogen? Okay, yeah, but don't say hydrogen. Hydrogen's got to be there. Nitrogen? Oxygen. Ooh, what do you see there? Oxygen, nitrogen, sulfur. Right? So here is a compound that has this nice polar group. So this part of the molecule does what? It likes to dissolve in water. It will allow this molecule to dissolve in water. All right, so what were those four atoms that can produce a polar covalent bond? Nitrogen, oxygen, sulfur, phosphorus. What about this hexane right here? Do you see sulfur, phosphorus, nitrogen, oxygen anywhere in here? No, it doesn't have any polar covalent bonds with this hydrogen, so this molecule is going to be a nonpolar molecule. Will it dissolve in water? No way, right? No way, because it doesn't have any polar compounds on it. Well, this one right here, it can. All right, so here we have that carbon backbone with a sulfhydryl group, that sulfur group. Does this produce a polar or nonpolar bond right here? Polar, which means can dissolve in water. All right, so here's a sulfhydryl. Here is an amino group. Amino group is NH2. Polar or nonpolar? Polar. It means that will allow this molecule to dissolve in water. Where have you run into amino before? Some people know something about amino acids. Amino acids are a building block of proteins. Amino acids are polar. They can dissolve in water partly because of that amino group right there. Okay. Last one, carboxyl group. Here we have a CO2H, right? And so this is a polar bond, covalent bond right here. Furthermore, this compound that has a carboxyl group on it, this hydrogen atom can jump off and become a proton in solution, right? It can donate a proton to the solution that this compound is dissolved in. And so what can you tell me about this carboxyl group? What does it do to the pH of that solution? Okay, the pH, it donates that hydrogen ion to solution. What happens to acidity? The acidity increases, right? Because that's what the definition of an acid is a molecule that can donate a proton to solution. So it donates that proton to solution. The solution becomes more acidic. What about the pH? As the acidity goes up, the pH goes down. All right? So we actually talk about carboxylic acids. These are very reactive compounds. Okay? All right, here's a phosphate group. And when we say phosphate, please realize, look at the complexity of this molecule right here. It's just not a phosphate group. It has a number of oxygens. A couple of these oxygens have a hydrogen atom associated with it. One just has a double bond. So when we say phosphate, usually we think of this whole group of atoms associated with it. And guess what? These hydrogens right here can jump off the oxygen, just like in a carboxylic acid. So this phosphate group can act as an acid when it donates these protons to solution. Right, and as this hydrogen, when it leaves that phosphate group, it's just a proton. This oxygen ends up with the electron, so we have a negative sign right here. So does that make this molecule, this phosphate molecule, polar or nonpolar? Will it dissolve in water or not? Okay. When that hydrogen leaves, that leaves the oxygen with a big negative charge. Does that allow it to dissolve in water or no? Yeah, that allows phosphate to dissolve in water because of that oxygen that has that negative charge on it. Okay. All right, so these are what we would call organic acids, right? They're organic because you see what? Carbon and hydrogen. You don't always have to draw the hydrogen. If you just have a simple straight line right there, that means that it is actually forming a covalent bond with a hydrogen. That's the nomenclature that's used. Okay. So these could be like an alcohol kind of group, right? So I want you to know this structure right here and its name. Carbonyl group, hydroxyl group, sulfhydryl group, amino, carboxyl, and phosphate group. And that's going to change the function of these kinds of molecules. All right, we got some exercises that I don't know if we have time today. I'll see if I can find it. We can get started with a little flash quiz to help you remember that kind of stuff. Okay, so let's turn our attention to not organic compounds necessarily. All right, I think all of these compounds are organic, but I want you to think of these as, more importantly, important biological compounds that can be divided into various classifications. And there's four important classifications. I can't find the slide quickly. The important classifications are carbohydrates is number one. What's another name for a carbohydrate? That would be a sugar, or sometimes we would call that a saccharide or polysaccharide. So a carbohydrate is a sugar. Think of it as a sugar. That's one kind. Another kind of compound would be a lipid. Okay, lipids. That's a second one. A third one will be proteins. And a fourth class of compounds will be nucleic acids. So those are the four. Carbohydrates, lipids, proteins, and nucleic acids. And you're going to see some characteristics of these different compounds and probably why they're used in your body because of the structure of these things. These are classes of biological compounds. All right, your book maybe calls them organic compounds. And it's true, they're organic, but they're important biologically. Because like hexane is, for instance, an organic compound, but it's not important biologically. Okay. So here we have a backbone made up of what kinds of atoms? Carbon atoms. All right, so here is a nonpolar bond to this hydrogen, but on the other side of the molecule, we have an OH group. What kind of covalent bond is being formed here? It's a covalent bond, but is it polar or nonpolar? It's polar. So this compound is loaded with these polar covalent bonds right here, right? So that means what? Will it dissolve in water or not? Yes, tons of it will dissolve in water. We'll love to because of all these polar compounds. This right here is glucose. Glucose has how many carbons in it? How many do you see right there? It's got six, and just like hexane, what can it do? It can fold back on itself and form a cyclic structure or a ring, right? So that's pretty much how it exists in our body as this ring structure right here. All right, there are other kinds of sugars. Here's another one called galactose. How many carbons does it have? It's got six. So it's very similar to glucose, but let's look in this position right here. The difference is that in glucose, this OH is on the right-hand side, but in galactose, it's on the left-hand side. We're changing the structure of the molecule. Guess what else is changing? The function of the molecule. It's going to behave differently, okay, just because that small bit of structure changes. All right, but what about galactose? Is it soluble in water? Yeah, because of all these polar bonds right here. All right, here is fructose. How many carbons does fructose have? Six. All right, but is the structure different than galactose and glucose? Sure, because of this carbonyl group, right? All right, so fructose is used differently in biological systems because the structure is a little bit different. But if we were to draw out or just write down the chemical formula for glucose and galactose and fructose, what would it be, starting with carbon? It would be C6, right? H, you count them up, 12, and how many oxygens? Six. Okay, and so when people started studying these compounds, they would break it down and measure the amount of carbons and hydrogens and oxygens in there. Let's divide this molecule by 6. So we got what? 6 over 6, 12 over 6, and then 6 over 6. What is that equal to? 6 over 6 is just 1, so I won't write it down because it's just 1. What is this? 2. All right, and what's this over here? It's 1, so I won't write it down. So we got what? Carbon. What's that? What's H2O? Water. All right, so you could say carbohydrate, but why bother when you can just say carbohydrate, right? So carbohydrates, means that for every carbon you have, basically like a water molecule stuck to it. Okay. So now you should maybe see something kind of interesting, and that is a lot of biological molecules have something very common with the solution that our bodies are dissolved in. What's the chemical that our body is dissolved in? Most of our body is made out of water, and we're going to see that water plays a very important role in many chemical reactions because water is basically a part of the molecules that our bodies are made out of. So water is not only the solvent that we're dissolved in, but it's an important molecule that participates in many chemical reactions that run our body. So that's pretty interesting. Okay, so you will have to recognize these as being simple sugars, simple six-carbon sugars, but I won't ask you to tell me which one is which. All right, in a chemistry class, a biochemistry class, you'll have to, of course, know which one is galactose, which one is fructose, which would be a pentose or other kinds of hexoses. But in here, you should just, when you see this compound, you should say that's a simple sugar. Or if you see these cyclic structures, that's a simple sugar. And these can be joined together. If we join two simple sugars together, we get a disaccharide. If we put three together, we get a trisaccharide. But if there's one just all by itself, we call that a monosaccharide. So a monosaccharide is just a simple sugar, and it's very polar. So what does it like to do in water? Dissolve in water, right? And you know that at home. When you go home, you have something called sucrose on your table, and you can put a lot of sucrose in water because of all those polar covalent bonds. So here are some other little bit more complicated carbohydrates. Sucrose, table sugar, has got one glucose and one fructose molecule put together, joined together covalently. So what kind of saccharide is that? Disaccharide, right? Lactose, or the sugar that we find in milk, has glucose but also a galactose. All right, and so galactose, they knew, was a sugar in milk. What color is milk? Kind of white. When you look up at the sky when it's really, really dark and you see the Milky Way, okay, or galaxies up in the sky, it looks kind of white, right? That's how they named the sugar, because it reminded somebody of stars up in the sky, right? Galactose. All right, and maltose is another disaccharide. It's just got two glucoses put together. Okay, so as a matter of fact, we can put thousands of glucoses together to make a huge molecule. Plants do that all the time. Okay, that would not be a monosaccharide or a disaccharide. If we put thousands of glucoses together, we call that a polysaccharide. And anybody know the name of a polysaccharide? Maybe even the one I'm thinking of? Who can read my mind yet? That would be, in plants, that would be called starch. Okay, that's the storage form of glucose in corn and wheat. Okay, potatoes, starch is basically just what? Glucose. Right? So if somebody's a diabetic, do you think they have to be concerned about their starch intake, the amount of bread or tortillas or potatoes they eat? Absolutely, because it's like eating what? It's like a sugar pill, okay? Even though it doesn't taste sweet, because they're all joined together. Okay, so now you can see why it's relating to physiology a little bit. Oh, here it is on this slide right here. So starch is what plants make. But in animals, we don't make a starch. It's called glycogen. The branching pattern is a little bit different. I'll show you some pictures eventually. So this is an important, both starch and glycogen are important storage molecules of, what's the name of that monosaccharide? Glucose, right. Okay, so starch and glycogen are ways that plants and animals store glucose in our bodies or the plant. And so, for a human, as your blood glucose goes down, your body wants to maintain blood glucose concentration. Where does it find glucose to put in the blood? It's in that glycogen. And the glycogen, especially in your liver, is used to maintain, if you don't have diabetes, maintain glucose concentration in your blood when you are in what? A fasted state. When you're in the fasted state, not fed state. Because when you're in a fed state, the glucose comes from your GI tract. Right, and you don't have to break glycogen down. Okay. All right, so now how does this happen? We're going to look at some chemical reactions. Formation of disaccharides. Here we have two glucose molecules, and they're going to bump into each other or be placed close to each other, maybe on the surface of an enzyme or something. And look, we have an OH group here and an OH group right here. And what's highlighted of those two OH groups? What's highlighted? H2O. What's H2O? Water. Well, that enzyme can put these two glucoses together, pull an H2O out of there, namely a water, and now these two glucoses are joined together by this oxygen bond, and what do we call glucose-glucose? That's just maltose. So this is what's called a dehydration synthesis reaction. Dehydration synthesis, because you are what? You're synthesizing maltose right here. Another way we talk about this chemical reaction is because we're pulling water out of it, we call it a dehydration reaction. So, or condensation, right? When water condenses out of the air, it forms around your glass or something. So again, what I want you to see is water is the solvent in our body, but it also participates in most of the chemical reactions that actually run our bodies. All right, so that's a dehydration synthesis reaction. Not just for glucose-glucose, but to make sucrose. Here's a glucose and a fructose. Here we have an OH, and here we have an OH. These can, right, form a bond, a nice covalent bond right here. Water is pulled out, and now we have a disaccharide that we call sucrose. And what's the name of this reaction right here? Dehydration synthesis reaction, okay? Or a dehydration or condensation reaction, okay? Now, this reaction can actually go backwards and forwards. And your book doesn't show you the reverse reaction. All right, let me go back to this. The reverse reaction would be taking a disaccharide and making what out of it? Two monosaccharides. That would not be a dehydration or synthesis reaction. All right, what would you need to break this bond between this maltose? You would need water. All right, so this reaction, all of these reactions are what we call hydrolysis reactions. When water is used to break this bond to convert a disaccharide into two monosaccharides, that is hydrolysis. Okay, so again, you can see the importance of your body regulating hydrogen ion concentration because what? It's going to affect the balance of dehydration synthesis versus hydrolysis reactions in your body all over the place. Okay, so the what do we call the forward direction right here? Dehydration synthesis. What do we call the reverse reaction? Hydrolysis. All right, so you got to be a little bit familiar with that. Okay, so how would you make, what kind of reaction would your body use to make a polysaccharide like glycogen? Okay, your choices are dehydration synthesis or hydrolysis. Dehydration synthesis. They're taking monosaccharides and making a big molecule out of it. Dehydration synthesis. When you're in a fasted state, your blood glucose drops, okay, and your body goes to your liver to take glucose from glycogen and put it in your blood. What kind of reaction does your body use to put that glucose, to chop glucose off of glycogen and put that glucose in blood? What kind of reaction is used? Hydrolysis reaction. Okay, what other molecule is necessary for a hydrolysis reaction to take place? Water. It needs a water for every glucose that is chopped off. Okay. All right, you're going to get the hang of this pretty quick right here. Let's talk about lipids. Okay. Yeah. Oh, raise your hand. Oh, I see you. Okay. Yeah? It sure does. Well, you know, I don't know if your book, the book that I got these pictures from didn't actually have the reverse direction. Okay, so if you maybe want to change this arrow, cross this arrow off. I didn't Photoshop it. Maybe I'll try to do that, right? So it would be the reverse direction here. Reverse direction here would be what? Hydrolysis. So cross that out and put the arrow on the other side. Yeah. Yeah. That's just dissociation. We call that dissociation of a strong acid. So a strong acid is one, when you put it in water, completely dissociates. You won't find any HCl anywhere. It will dissociate completely to hydrogen ion and chloride. Other acids are weaker acids like carbonic acid. When you put carbonic acid in solution, it won't all break down to bicarbonate and hydrogen ion. There will always be a little bit of carbonic acid there and some hydrogen and some bicarbonate. So we call that a weak acid. Okay. So your body doesn't necessarily use, well, it uses strong acid. I just remember. Where does your body use a strong acid? In your stomach. Your stomach actually produces hydrochloric acid, a very reactive mixture in your stomach so that you can digest proteins. All right, but your stomach has got to be really specially designed to handle that kind of acidity. And that doesn't always work for people. What do they get if it's not working right? Ulcers, stomach ulcers, right? Esophageal ulcers. Okay. Let's turn our attention to lipids. After I say one last thing. Here we have a carbon with, or we have an oxygen with a covalently bound hydrogen. What kind of covalent bond is that? Polar or nonpolar? That's polar, so it dissolves in water. Now let's look at some lipids. Okay? Lipids are insoluble in polar solvents, like water. So we call those hydrophobic compounds. Sugars, since they dissolve in water, we would call them hydrophilic. They love water. They'd like to be associated with water because of their polar natures. All right, so hydrophobic compounds or molecules consist primarily of hydrocarbon chains and rings, which means there's a carbon that has a hydrogen bound to it. It's not a polar covalent bond. Therefore, they can't bind in water. Okay, here we have a compound that is what we call a fatty acid. You notice a carboxyl group right here, which makes this end of the molecule slightly soluble in water, but look at the rest of the molecule. And we don't even draw the whole thing out over here. It can have as many as 18 carbon atoms making up this backbone. And in each one of these positions, you just have what? A nonpolar covalent bond to this hydrogen. So fatty acids are only partly soluble in water, all right? But it's got this very reactive carboxyl group. Here is another compound. How many carbon atoms do you see in this compound right here? It's got three, okay? What molecule could you make this from? We call this glycerol. You know a molecule that we could make this from by chopping it in half. What molecule could you use by chopping it in half to make glycerol? Okay, glucose, because how many carbons does glucose have? It's got six. You chop it in half, you get this thing right here that's got three. We call this glycerol, and on each one of these carbons, you have this OH group. All right? So that makes it fairly reactive with this carboxyl group on this fatty acid. Remember, a carboxyl group is what? An acidic group, makes this group acidic. So we have an OH and OH right here. What can we do with this group? We can use it to pull a water molecule out to make a nice covalent bond at this position right here. And the same for the middle carbon and the other carbon on glycerol on the other end. So you can take three fatty acids, join them to glycerol to make something that we call a triglyceride. Probably everybody's heard of a triglyceride, and now you know kind of how it's made. All right, so when your body makes a triglyceride from three fatty acids and glycerol, what chemical reaction is used? It's a dehydration synthesis reaction. Have we run into that before? Sure, when we make a polysaccharide from monosaccharides. So it's such a handy reaction, your body doesn't have to invent another one. Here it is, right here, ready to go to work to make a triglyceride. Okay, so I could ask you, what are the building blocks of a polysaccharide? Monosaccharide. It's really good to know building blocks in this class. Okay. What are the building blocks of a triglyceride? Three fatty acids and a glycerol. And you're going to see you can get glycerol from glucose under certain conditions. Okay. And how would you make a triglyceride from the building blocks? Dehydration synthesis, just like you can make a polysaccharide from monosaccharides by using what kind of chemical reaction? Okay, making a polysaccharide from its building blocks is a dehydration synthesis, just like making a triglyceride from its building blocks is a dehydration synthesis reaction. All right, let's go back to the polysaccharide once again. If you got a polysaccharide and you want a bunch of monosaccharides, what kind of reaction do you use? You use hydrolysis. So if you have a triglyceride right here and you want to generate building blocks, namely fatty acids or glycerol, what kind of chemical reaction does your body use? Hydrolysis reaction. Because here you have what? The triglyceride, and what you got? Water. So these are going to be the reactants that are going to produce these products right here. That's what we call a hydrolysis reaction. When we take water and break these bonds right here, so the water ends up in these molecules, that is a hydrolysis reaction. Okay. Going the other way would be a dehydration synthesis reaction. Going reverse, hydrolysis. Okay, here are some other diagrams of fatty acids that we use in our body. There are a number of different kinds of fatty acids based on the length of this hydrocarbon chain. All right, so here we have this long hydrocarbon chain right here. Is this the polar end or the nonpolar end of the molecule? Nonpolar. Is it hydrophilic or hydrophobic? It's hydrophobic because there are no polar bonds. And this carboxyl end right here makes it reactive and a little bit soluble in water. Okay. And this one, it's called palmitic acid. It's completely, at every carbon, there are two hydrogens, so we call that a saturated fatty acid. It doesn't have to have two hydrogens. There could be a double bond in this location, and then one of these hydrogens will come off to give you this structure right here. This is what we call an unsaturated fatty acid, because not every carbon has a hydrogen. That's going to put a little kink or a bend in the molecule, and that's going to change its behavior. Do people know that there's a difference between saturated and unsaturated fatty acids in your diet? Yeah, they have health consequences, right? So when you change the structure of a molecule, what are you changing? The function, what it's doing inside your body, right? Just by removing hydrogens can change the function completely. All right, so this shows you the difference between saturated and unsaturated. You don't have to know the names of these, but when you see this compound right here, would you say that is a monosaccharide? No. Monosaccharides are what? Carbohydrates, carbon with water, H2O on them. No H2Os right here. This is going to be a fatty acid, right? And this is a fatty acid as well. Okay. Let's look at this diagram. This is maybe one of the most important molecules that you're going to look at in this class. Some guy might say ATP is the most important molecule. Of course, all the molecules are important in your body. That's like saying your heart is the most important organ in your body. Well, I wouldn't want to give my brain away, or a plethora of other organs as well, right? So it's not really appropriate to say which is the most important, but this is critically important. Let's take a look at this molecule right here, starting with this thing that has three carbon atoms on it. Does that remind you of anything? 1, 2, 3, which is glycerol. What can we add to glycerol? We can add a fatty acid to it. Okay, so let's go back. So here is glycerol. This first position, we've added a fatty acid. You can see the carboxyl group right here. And this is the long hydrophobic chain. In the second position, here's a long hydrophobic chain, carboxyl group bound to glycerol. But in this last position right here, this carbon atom is not bound to a fatty acid, but it's bound to a phosphate group. And what about this phosphate group? Is it hydrophilic or hydrophobic? It's hydrophilic. This end of the molecule likes to dissolve in water. What about this nitrogen group right here? Hydrophilic means that this thing right here really loves to dissolve in water, but what about these long hydrocarbon chains? Are hydrophobic, doesn't want to dissolve in water. So here you have a really interesting molecule. Half of it wants to dissolve in water and the other half does not. And this is going to perform some magic in our bodies just because of the different nature on this molecule. Okay, so this end is polar, this end over here is nonpolar. We diagram this compound with this big hydrophilic head group and these tails right here, which are hydrophobic. So So this end likes to dissolve in water. This one does not. And since it has phosphate, we call that a phospholipid. Right, a phospholipid. It has both a phosphate and a lipid part to it. And phospholipids. Maybe from anatomy, you could remember what organelle makes lipids. Anybody remember? Okay, I can maybe stimulate your understanding a little bit. What organelle can make a protein? So that's different than what we're talking about. What can make a protein? Ribosomes do. There is another membrane system that has ribosomes attached to it, which means that it can make proteins. That is rough endoplasmic reticulum. Okay? What's the other kind of endoplasmic reticulum? Smooth. That's the organelle that can make phospholipids. Okay? Because we're going to get into cells sooner or later in here, I think. Right? So smooth ER makes these little guys right here. All right. So, maybe I can describe the magic of this molecule right here, and you can do this experiment when you go home. Where's a good marker? Let's try these that are dark. Let's take an item you're all familiar with, right? Because the lecture so far might seem a little freaky to a lot of students. Maybe you haven't heard any of this kind of stuff before, but you got to do a little repetition to become more familiar with it. So, what do I got right here? A bottle, and in particular, a salad dressing bottle. All right? So, right here on the top, that's the top of the salad dressing. But what can you tell me about this salad dressing bottle? Is it nice and homogeneous? Or what about all the little pieces and particles and stuff that you find that as it's sitting in the refrigerator? Do you take it out of the refrigerator and just pour it right on your salad? No. Because what are you going to end up with? You're just going to end up with oil because oil is less dense than water. All right, so all the oil is going to end up right here. And it is hydrophobic because they're just hydrocarbon chains. It doesn't want to have anything to do with water. Where do you find water? Here's H2O. Down over here, it's heavier, and all the spices and everything else are dissolved in water. Okay, so here's oil, here's water. And now, what do we got? We've got this molecule right here. What is this molecule? Phospholipid. It's got two ends. What is this end? This is phyllic, right? And here is phobic. Let's put this molecule in here. Where is it going to go? Is it going to go in the oil? Is it going to go in the water? Which one of those two places? It's actually going to go in both. I was trying to be a trick question. So now how would it go? The phyllic part is going to go here, and what about the phobic part? It's going to stick up there. Now, if you put that molecule in here, is there anything that you have to do special to get that molecule exactly in that location? It will just automatically go there by magic because of the hydrophilic and hydrophobic nature of that molecule. You don't have to go in there with a tweezers or anything. Right, a little old car, and stick it right there. It will just go there automatically because of that nature. All right, so you got to remind me where I left off. We're going to have to finish up the salad dressing bottle next time. I'm going to give, let me just say one thing. Okay, the sign-in sheet. Everybody sign the sign-in sheet? You have to. Who's got the sign-in sheet? Okay, so bring it down to the front. Make sure you sign the sign-in sheet.